Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now. Another week. This is We Talk Productions presenting Black Urban America, and my name is Kenny Jones. Black Urban America airs 8 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday evenings, and on Saturday evenings we have Carlton Steve with Provocative Thought. And also we have a marketing partnership program for self-employed and small business owners. We Talk Productions have a program that will assist you in exposing your products and or your services. If you're interested, please dial 404-573-6144. Tonight, I have a special guest, and she hails from Michigan. She ran for the state representative for the Michigan State Capitol. Also, she's an advocate for a Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. Also, she also is an advocate for a Michigan Coalition Against Homelessness. Her name is Ms. Dana Knight. Welcome to Black Urban America, Ms. Knight.
Thank you. Thank you. You also forgot to mention that I'm the organizer, local organizer here for Black Lives Matter, Greater Grand Rapids.
Oh, okay. Okay. And how is that coming along?
Well, I'm actually in the process of relaunching the chapter here and in the process of doing some fundraising here with some local churches and organizations and producing artwork that could be sold. So my goal is to have a launch party by January in the new year.
Oh, okay. Okay, let me ask you something, Ms. Knight, before I go into a series of questions and thoughts and views and perspective. How come when something happens in our community, we are protesting, we're meeting, we're advocating, and then after a week or so where everything died down, with the traditional media no longer discuss the issue, we go to sleep. So how can we continue to address these issues around the country? How can we maintain our consistency?
Well, I'm going to disagree with you that it dies down. In Ferguson and St. Louis, those people are over there on the ground all the time and fighting every day. We just don't hear about it. You know, the media is not going to let you know about that. So there are hot spots where they consistently are advocating and they don't let up. Just certain, you know, overall I would say that most people do. They start and they quit. But there are people that are still fighting daily, you know, daily. I mean,
that's good to hear, because this is a journey. It took us hundreds and hundreds of years to get to this point, and it's going to take a little time. You know, we just can't have this immediate gratification. We've got to be at it daily, daily, weekly, and monthly. So tell me something about the 77th district that you ran for.
Well, I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan, born and raised. A few years ago, I moved into a suburb called Wyoming, Michigan, which is basically a 10-minute drive on a freeway due to gentrification that was starting in Grand Rapids. I was a live-in home caregiver for my mother, and she died. And I had to move from her apartment. Well, actually, they had offered me that I could stay in her apartment, even though it was in a senior citizen building, but it was also where she died. So I said no and ended up looking for housing and was on numerous waiting lists. So in the meantime, I came over to the Wyoming area and found an apartment immediately, and I became a resident in the city of Wyoming. That is part of the 77th district. It's Wyoming and Byron Center.
Okay. Okay. Grand Rapids, the second largest city in Michigan, is it not?
It is. It is.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure I have that right. Now, as I stated earlier, you was a candidate for a state representative. I've been a part of a couple of campaigns in my lifetime. I want to know the candidate. What does the candidate go through? But that is a 24-hour 7 day a week for about how many months up to the election, grinding, fast paced, diligence. How is it on the candidate? Tell me. I know how it is on the staff, but how is it on the candidate internally?
Well, it's not like that here. Grand Rapids is not, like you say, we're the second largest city to Detroit, and we don't have the machine like Detroit does. We're a very Republican, conservative city. So basically, I threw my hand in a year ago to run as a Democrat. I lost to a Republican, and it's actually gerrymandered for a Republican win here in the district that I'm at. Even though Byron Center is diverse and multicultural, the other part of the area, Byron Center, is predominantly white and Republican. So those are the people that end up defeating a Democratic opponent. I'm running again this year as a candidate. I do have an opponent that has stepped up as a Democrat that I will be running, having a runoff against, but I'm in it again for a second time. And it's not, like you said, really, you know, a grind or, you know, it's not a fast-paced type of, you know, the way we do elections over here. Basically, I'm just doing what I always do, which is, you know, advocating and being a part of different organizations and speaking up and standing up and voicing, you know, what I feel is best for the community and for the residents, you know, wherever I live, and that I've always been that way. But you had brought up Grand Rapids, and one of the issues that we have here in Grand Rapids is there's been several national magazines that have come here due to a worldwide event that's called Art Prize. And that draws, you know, hundreds of thousands of people from all over the country come to Grand Rapids for 3 weeks in the fall. And when Forbes magazine and Newsweek magazine and another national magazine came out, they started looking at that, wow, this is a really great city. And where are the black people at? And what do they have going on for black folks? So out of that, they did some research and found that Grand Rapids, Michigan is one of the worst states, cities, for black Americans.
Yeah, 51 out of 52, right? I forgot who came in last.
And we have a lot of wealth.
Why is Grand Rapids so economically not friendly to African Americans? Why is that?
Because they don't have to be. That's the main reason. There's been, basically the blacks that should have been advocating and fighting never did. Or they were self-serving. We don't even have any wealthy black people that live in Grand Rapids. So, we can't point to any black person that we can go here to that has really, really done really, really well. And if you need money, that they're the money people. We don't have black people like that here. And that's due to, basically I would use the word Uncle Tommy and doing things that would benefit them and screwing over the black community. So that is the main reason, is that nobody would stand up or say anything to the white power structure here. Mm-hmm. And then the ones that did, they went along with what the white people wanted them to do. So that's, partly the reason. And one of the things that, as a Black Lives Matter member, as someone who's running for state rep, I've been addressing that whenever I speak. And recently in July of this past summer, it was the 50th anniversary to the Grand Rapids 1967 riots. Everybody knows about the Detroit 67 riots. But Grand Rapids also had some riots in July of 1967. And they did an anniversary issue, the news media did, and discovered that 50 years later, black people in Grand Rapids are more impoverished than they were 50 years ago.
Mm.
We haven't made any economic gains.
What do you think?
We are poorer today than we were in 1967, and you know how bad stuff was in 1967.
Yeah, yeah.
So if it's 2017, the white folks got their hands on our backs heavy. That we had, and it's been like that for 50 years.
And now they have gentrification.
Correct, yeah.
Now they want you out of the city.
Right.
If you can't,
and there's nowhere for us to go, right. Yeah, as what's going on across the, not just the United States, but across the world, where white people are coming back and wanting to reclaim the land that they abandoned to get away from us. Now they want to come back into the cities, and they don't care how it happens, as long as it happens, which always displaces, people. And we have nowhere to go when they do that. We don't have the situation like they do in Flint, where they poison the water to try to get rid of the people. We've already had our water poisoned when they put fluoride in it. And so everybody is actually poisoned by the water. But we don't have anywhere for us to go, whereas Flint, they do have areas where they want the black people to move to. They've given them Section 8 and subsidies to move, and a lot of them refuse, whereas we don't have any place set aside for us to go live.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know, as I was trying to say, that in the area that I'm from, we lost Harlem, Stuyvesant, East New York, North New Jersey, Jersey City, yep. New Jersey, Philadelphia.
Yep. Yep.
No, the affluent suburbs have become, they got a new name now called inner suburbs. And like you said, white folks are reclaiming the cities that they ran in the late 60s during the uprising, and they took their factories, their resources, their money with them. And now they're coming back and displacing us. I mean, home people that been having, I mean, Bedford-Stuyvesant have been in the black hands since the late 1800s. And it's the next city to go, Atlanta, Georgia. They would elect a white mayor for the first time in since 1974, and you should see that when they tell me there used to be black pockets of living, you know, and what have you, and it's gone. It's gone. Like this brother from Compton, California said, once you see them bulldozers, it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow you got to be in on the ground floor to try to fight the gentrification that is going on. And I mean, there are a lot of solutions, a lot of perspectives on the solution of what we should do. But the first thing we have to do is, like, really clean up our neighborhoods. I mean, some neighborhoods have not came back from the 80s, the crack epidemic in the 80s, and really had destroyed some of our black family structure, and which is a phenomenon today.
Well, one of the things I want to say about gentrification, like you were talking about what's going on in Atlanta, and they have a white mayor, and they did that in Detroit as well, where there's no more black power. Right. Yeah, white mayor. The city is slowly coming back. Money is coming back because there's a white mayor. But one of the things I want to say, like you were talking about bulldozers, these things just don't happen overnight. It's usually a master plan, and it's 10 years in advance. So the things that are happening across the country, like you said, you see the bulldozers, you can't stop it. It was already in momentum, but we didn't know about it. But it was on the city plan. So, no, you can't stop it once you see the bulldozers. They planned this stuff 10 years ago. And just like when you're talking about where areas need to be cleaned up, those areas are kept like that on purpose so that later on they can come back and take it. You know, nothing random happens. It's all planned. It's all planned.
It's all by design.
You hate to think that's how evil they are, but when you look at even the freeway systems across the country, it was designed to where white folks wouldn't have to see and deal with black people, and they cut through communities that were predominantly black to put the freeway systems in. And it didn't just happen one city, one state. It happened all over the country. So what happens one place happens another place. You know, once the white man see, oh, this works, they all do it. So it's everything is the master plan, the master design. And they're actually excellent at implementing it.
So how, as a community, how can we make attempts to slow down gentrification in our communities?
How can we slow down
the other communities from coming under the rule of gentrification?
Well, I'm fighting, you know, as a Black Lives representative here, regarding gentrification that is happening in a community that was purchased by Anway DeVos family. They bought property the last couple of years, $10 million worth of property in all black community that have 11,000 residents. And at one point when I was in high school, I lived over in that neighborhood, and I had a mechanic who he actually sold his property for $300,000. And he had two shops and three homes in the area. And that was when I first knew, I didn't know that, you know, the master plan, the big plan, and how much money they spent. But they've been slowly going around and buying out businesses and buying abandoned, you know, buildings. And so this past summer, they started doing community engagement meetings, which did not go well at all. We were supposed to end the last one December 7th, but in September, due to pushback from myself and other community leaders and advocates, they decided that they needed to get to know the community needs and concerns and cancel the remaining three meetings we were supposed to have. But ultimately, they are behind the scenes still doing what they're going to do. They just didn't get the reception that they wanted from the people. And they're coming with things to reengage and to say that this is what the people wanted. And they're still going to do what they want to do because it's $10 million so far that they've invested. So what we're trying to do is say, you know, and I'm saying, okay, you got the property. We can't, you know, make you give it. Give it back to the people. Let us have a hand in designing what is going to go on in this community that has 11,000 residents. And you've said that you've made 22,000 contacts, which they never defined what contact was, to get the community involved. And everyone that was at the table, the meetings that I was going to, lived outside of the immediate area, and only six people who would come to the meetings, and usually it'd be 50 people, only six people actually lived in the community that was going to be impacted. So we told them that it was not fair that they get to, well, we get to vote. I don't even live in Grand Rapids, and I was going to the meetings and having a say. So we've been trying to mobilize people that actually live in the community. I have a godfather who said he never received any information from the company. The organization is called Amplify Grand Rapids, and he wasn't even aware of all that was going on. But then he said, well, ain't nothing we could do because they're going to do what they want to do anyway. And you know, the white folks here always do. So, but that's one way to fight is to say, okay, you know, let us get at the table and have some decisions, and you just don't take over and do what you want to do. That's not right and that's not fair. But despite it and all the research that I've done, I haven't been able to find anything or any place where they've actually done the people in those communities just and fair. So that's the problem.
Wow, that is really a that's really a sad experience there for anyone to endure. You know, losing your home and being displaced. I just want to talk about being displaced. I see that you are very much involved with as an advocate for the homeless. You know, even though we make 12% of the population, but we're 50% of the homeless population in the U.S. and in Detroit is 85%. Those numbers are disturbing to me. And we're not just talking about, I want the audience to know, we're not just talking about, you know, the stereotypical alcoholic or what have you. We talk about these are children and families and adolescents. You know, so can you explain to me how that fight is going?
Well, that is one reason, part of, there's going to be increased homelessness with gentrification. And that is also one of the, you know, like I said, I'm an advocate for homelessness, homeless people. And with my fight with the Amplify Grand Rapids, that is partly what it is for, because where are we going to go? Where are these people going to go? And you haven't taken care of the people that are already homeless, you know. So that is a major issue here in Grand Rapids as well, where people think that our local organizations are taking care of the problem, and they are not. And we have enormous amount of, you know, mothers who are homeless with their children. We have teens that are homeless and living with different people and on the street. And I deal with that as a teacher, having kids not have any stable housing. But as long as, you know, the face, it's like everything, you know, what I said, it's all planned and orchestrated. I look at when people talk about the police and all these community agencies, they are what I call engaged in job security. You know, they're not really trying to fix anything. They're just maintaining so that they stay employed. These agencies stay employed. Everything can be fixed, but they choose not to. So they make money off of people's misery. And that's the system that we have all over the country, all over the world. So there's ways to address it. And locally they have, you know, some homes that they have built just for teenagers and mothers with children who are homeless. But here we have a housing crunch where there's not enough housing and buildings to do that. And so people say, well, we don't have the money to take a building and rehab it, or we don't have the money to do construction, or we don't have a place to even do construction if we want to.
So what are some of the, what do you suggest some of the solutions should be to this problem? Because you said it's going to increase. That means like every other black African-American is going to be homeless pretty soon.
Right. And in the, and it's not just blacks, it's, you know, the Hispanic. We never, here locally, we rarely see Hispanic homelessness, but we know that it exists. The face of homelessness here in Grand Rapids is, of course, black people. And like you said, we're affected more than anybody. And like I said, the answers, locally they say there's no place for people to live. That people choose to be homeless. They like being out on the street. A lot of the people that are homeless do have mental health issues, or they have criminal records that prevent them from being able to get into housing because of discrimination against, you know, felons. They don't have the funds, or they've had prior evictions. So there are a host of social issues that most people come with, or I call them bags, that is generalized to say that, you know, they want to be where they are. And, you know, there are a percentage who are cool with living, you know, on the street. But the overwhelming population, I would never agree that they're okay, you know, being homeless. And again, I believe there are solutions, but people don't want those solutions because they're not going to be profitable for them and their agencies or their ministry. So as long as they feed them, as long as they give them a blanket, you know, it's business as usual.
As long as they feed them, as long as they give them a blanket. But my thing is, how about the family unit? How about that child that got to go to school every day? There's other entities that have to be addressed besides giving them a blanket and giving them a piece of bread. You know, we talk about making progress for this family or giving the family resources so they can make and so they don't have to be dependent on government agencies. I mean, anybody coming up with that perspective, or it just like you said, it's just put off
on government agencies. Locally, if you even look at all the black churches, where any city without the money they make, and if they said, okay, let's address this issue of homelessness, and they pooled, you know, the money together. Believe me, you know, the powers that be is not going to be happy with that. And they're going to come up with some solutions to, you know, the housing problem. But as long as we leave it up to them to do it, it's business as usual. They're going
to
maintain.
Yeah, we're just a number to them. But where are we? Let's forget about the government agencies for a minute. You just said something very important. I bet you on any given Sunday, churches are raising in that pulpit. I said, ooh, I'll go pick over $10 million, it's safe to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And our neighborhoods, because we do give. We are givers. It's our nature. You mean to tell, when are we going to stop being afraid of the powers to be, or I might lose my standing in the community or in the city, or they might out me in the church, or they might try to discredit me. I mean, when are we going to stop being scared and this more word unify? I mean, if you just have the churches alone address these problems and just deal 3-5% of their revenue, we could have a substantial amount to not put a dent in it, but start building some affordable housing.
Yeah,
I mean, when are we going to stop being scared that I'm trying to ask you?
Well, I look at it at a different perspective. We're scared, but we also, you know, how some of us black folks is, we don't want other black folks to have or do nothing and or have live better than us, or have more than us, or drive something better than us. So it's a complicated, you know, question, because we're scared on many fronts, you know. And I look at with the church is an entity in itself. You know, people don't look at them, but they're businesses. And,
yes.
And they're in the business to make money, but they're not in the business to give money out. And I feel I could address that issue better than when we're going to stop being scared. But I think if churches, you know, like you said, as much money as they pull in every Sunday, and if they started investing in community, giving that money back that, you know, we talked about, we can't get money from banks, you know, the churches should start their own banking systems, investment systems, and some, you know, have and done very well. But overall, they should be more engaged and more involved, and supposedly be more Christian to the people in the community, and they aren't. A lot of them have parishioners that are homeless and don't have a place to stay, and they're not bending over backwards to help them. So I don't have an answer, you know, as to why we're scared, why we don't do the right thing, why we don't look at, after each other as brother and sister, other than that that's how we've been conditioned not to.
Mm. Wow. What happened to the village?
Right. Yeah, we talk all that, but we don't act it. It ain't what you say, it's what you do.
Yeah. How James Brown say it, talk about ain't saying nothing. I see that you're involved with a coalition on gun violence.
Yes, I am. Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Your list is so long. I just can't say it all. But I want to ask you: when do you sleep? do you sleep at night?
I'm a night owl, but I do sleep. I take my naps. Like, actually, I just woke up around 6:37. I take 2-hour naps every day. I love to sleep, so I do sleep, and then that allows me, when I take naps, to stay up late. But I have to be at work at 7:30, and I usually get up at 6 and go to bed around midnight. And so I sleep well. Yeah. But I'm involved with the Michigan Gun Coalition. I got involved a few years ago and became an advocate and spokesperson for I've actually spoken at the state capitol regarding my story with gun violence. I have a lot of them, but the one that I shared at that time was in regards to my father. When he was 3 years old, he shot and killed his sister, who was 2, with a shotgun. Now, they lived in Alabama, and it was back in the era where guns are, were commonplace to be in the
home.
Still
is.
Well, but it wasn't, it still is, most definitely, you're right. But today we're supposed to put the guns away. Back in his era, the gun might be on the table or something, And the family was getting ready to go to church, and they got the little ones dressed first and got them out of the way and told them to go play. And my grandmother remembered that my grandfather left the gun on the couch. And as she was running to the living room, she heard the gun go off. And my dad's little sister, who nicknamed him Nene because she couldn't say his name, which is Sherlock, she called him Nene. And she said, "Nene, shoot me, shoot me." And she lifted up her dress, and he picked up the gun and shot her. Now, they also lived on a farm and in the country, where they shot and killed, game. So to them, it was like a game. They were playing a game and not knowing that it was going to be deadly. So my speech was that he never felt, he was officially the baby, and he never felt real love from his mother or his older siblings. And so that's what I spoke about, that when my dad died in 2013, none of his older, siblings that were alive, even though they're in their 80s and he was the younger one, none came to his funeral. None have called and to ask me how I'm doing, if you're okay. He always felt like he was the black sheep. And my story was how I ended up feeling that way too, that the support that you would normally expect to get, I didn't receive that from my family. So so that was how I described how I and others are affected with gun violence. But I have many more stories of guns that the role that gun played in my family.
Do you think people should own guns?
Oh, that is a hard question to answer. Not if they can't be safe with them. You know, recently there was an article I posted on my Facebook page about a child, you know, 2-3 year old being killed, shot themselves in the head with a gun. How the hell does that happen? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it just seems that people don't know how to be safe. Recently, they ruled here that you can carry a gun in the school here in Michigan, you know, concealed gun in the school. Why would anybody want to do that, especially with the mass murders we've had in with schools throughout our history and the recent killings? But here in Michigan, they ruled that you could have a gun on you and enter a school building. Some teachers are supportive of that.
I'm
in
not.
Case somebody comes
wrong.
In and,
teachers
you know,
carry
but,
guns.
Right.
I don't know about
come
that.
To? Right.
But
right.
You know what your president said, right? And since we are the president, what is going on at the White House? I mean, other countries got to be looking at us and say, they're gone mad. They're gone
well,
mad.
Yeah,
I've been known of Donald Trump since 1982. And everything he touches just turns to manure. And I just can't understand. I understand. You know, had a genius for 5 by 8 years. I mean, he made the president before Obama look like a genius. Everybody was calling him the president. Now, if he made that president look like, I think, George Bush, the 43rd president, if he made the 43rd president look like a genius, I mean,
well,
and he made some blunders too. You know what he wants to do? He wants to Iran. He wants North Korea. And I forgot the other country that he's breathing down on, but Iran and North Korea is at the top. Do you think that we are heading to war? I mean, Afghanistan is not over yet, and they're still fighting Syria, and America's backing troops in different parts of the world. But do you think that we're going to another world war?
Well, it might not be a war, a world war, but it most definitely is going to be a war of some kind, because that's how rich people make money. And he's in there to help rich people make money. So, yeah, we're going to be going to war. War is very, very profitable.
Do you think he's going to make it through the 4 years?
That he's going to make it 4 years?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When you said what's going on in the White House and it's white supremacy on full... on full display, and he's doing the buffoonery that all white supremacists have done, you know, historically. We're gonna go to war. He's gonna stay in the office for 4 years.
You think he'll get a second term?
I think it's very possible that he could. Yeah. I mean, it'd have to be some major, major turn of events that happen, you know, in the next 3 years. And so far, nothing has happened to wane his support and his support base. There's no moral conscience that he has, and people enjoy that. They like that. He's speaking for... he's representing the people that voted for him, even if it hurts them personally, as long as they feel that it hurts other people. So I think he has a good chance of being there 4 years and getting reelected again. he's mobilizing, you know, people to get out and, you know, vote now. But they have to keep that momentum going, you know, for the next 4 years. But everything he's tried to do, you know, has backfired. But yeah, he has a great chance of maintaining his presidency, and I'm sure, you know, like I said, unless something terrible happens, you know, I look at him running again.
You know, there's going to be a lot of seats open in 2018. I know you know that, but I'm just saying. How do you think the Democrats are going to do next year? Because there was some major upsets last week.
Right.
Some major upsets.
Yeah. You had transgenders, you had Shiite, you had gay, lesbian people winning, black women winning. So right now people seem to be, you know, voicing their concern with getting Democratic candidates in office. But it's really hard to say how things are going to turn, because I look at the Democratic Party is still the old Democratic Party. It's still the old girls and old boys network. And they're talking one way, but they're not actually talking what they preach. When I ran last year, I didn't get any support from, you know, my local Democrats. Their money, you know, they come with their philosophies and their statistics and their polls, and they use that to judge who they think is going to win and who deserves money, who deserves their support. And I look at that they're not, you know, wanting and willing to change. When we had a convention back in January, they all voted themselves back in as leadership. But then, you know, everybody's saying that the Democrats need to turn it around. And so it was very surprising. You know, people weren't expecting all the latest Democratic wins. So far people are speaking at the ballot, but if that continues, you know, we don't know. I'm hoping, when I ran last year, I received over 15,000 votes, which were predominantly from white people. The area I live in is diverse, but it's predominantly white Democrats. My opponent, who owns a chain of restaurants and has name recognition, he received 27,000 votes. So I campaigned without any money and received 15,000. So the goal is, hopefully I will be able to get some money and do, you know, much better and go against, you know, the statistics and the polls and, you know, win this November 2018.
And what office you going to run for next year? The same one, state representative?
Yes, yeah, state representative, District 77 Michigan State House.
Okay.
I'd also like to add,
a couple minutes left, Ms. Knight, or future elect state representative Knight. You have anything to say to her?
I said I appreciate that. I would like to say that, you know, I'm also on the line fighting with our brown brothers and sisters, the immigrants, the Hispanics, the Latinos that are affected by the DACA reversal program, the Dreamers program. Locally, we're trying to get equal services for our immigrants here who have been terrorized by the police and ICE that are coming to arrest people and send them back home and leaving them, their families. You know, we were talking about homelessness, leaving, you know, children or taking, you know, displacing people due to the color of their skin. So those are things that, you know, there was a meeting that I was supposed to go to tonight to speak to city commissioners. regarding equal services and protections for them, because the police are doing their job as they have historically done, as working like as slave patrollers, and mm-hmm. are arresting and deporting our local immigrant community. So that is one of the things that I'm advocating and I'm fighting for, speaking up and joined other immigrant groups and organizations here in Grand Rapids.
Let me ask you one last question, Ms. Knight, before I go. Are you in communication with other black delegates and politicians around the country?
Well, last week I did attend the Women's March Convention in Detroit, and a lot of the women that I've met, they were recently elected or been in politics in their states. So I have been networking and getting people to know me and my story, but I'm not on a broad base connected, you know.
You said the Women's March Convention?
Yeah. If you remember, they had the Women's March back in January, and mm-hmm. it was all those white women with those pink pussy hats. And they've had, and they also had it in Washington, and each state or several states, whichever state wanted to, they had local. I didn't go to Washington. I went to Lansing where they had a march and rally. And then this past month, they had, not this month, but October, in October, they had a convention in Detroit, Michigan, which I attended.
Okay, Ms. Knight, you got to go. Ms. Knight, you have to come back on. You have to come back on in the new year. I really enjoyed our discussion. And there's other issues we never did hit on. But I enjoyed you. And thank you for coming on my show. But really, you really have to come back on.
Okay, in the meantime, I'm on Facebook. Elect Dana J. Knight for State House Representative. I'm also on Facebook as Dana Knight. And you can email me at djanellek@gmail.com if anyone would like to communicate or donate any funds for my cause or like to talk to me. I'm available.
Okay. Thank you so much. And
thank
get some
you,
sleep.
And I will be back. I'll be back.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate
All right.
It. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Very disturbing. Very some disturbing facts and perspective with the Black Lives Matter and the homeless of families and the gun violence. And just a negative atmosphere that is going on in this country, and I think that as African Americans, as Americans, we really got to look at our behavior and how we treat one another, and how we just like it's nothing to let a family be homeless. We talk about a mother with children. We talk about teenagers, you know, so, and the gun violence. And we really go into depth about the gun violence, but I will have her back on. And we will, I know between now and then, by the time she come back on, it's going to be some type of gun violence. You know, it's really going crazy. Well, as always, that's it for the show. And as I always sign off, I am because we are. We are because I am.
Hold it now.
Listen.
Oh! Come on, come
Don't forget. The Marky Partnership Program.